Welcome to Ask Lynn a New One. And for the first time on Ask Lynn, I'm actually interviewing a young man who's younger than me, thank you very much. He is 13, and believe it or not, he is a professional race car driver. 13, believe it or not, yeah. When I read that, I'm like, I love speed, but not me, not my back. And I secretly am an adrenaline junkie, so for me, it's the honor and privilege to interview Austin Edwards, and I'm going to let Austin take it away, and then I'm going to ask him 4 baseline questions, and then he's going to interview me and see what a 13-year-old pulls out of me. These questions are not planned, you guys, so mine are, but my guests are not. So we'll see what a 13-year-old pulls out of me. But I want to introduce you guys to Austin Edwards.
Hi, everybody. I'm 13 years old. I'm Austin Edwards. I'm pretty much a professional stock car driver. I've been racing since I was 5 years old in pretty much go-karts, and then I worked my way through the ranks. And now I'm in a full-size stock car with 500 horsepower and going about 120 miles an hour. And my goal is pretty much to make it to NASCAR, but I'm also trying to make a difference along the way.
So, okay, let's just get to the meat and potatoes here, because I know my fan base is now fascinated, as am I. But what's the scariest moment you've had doing this? What's the scariest moment you thought, oh, my God, here we go, and I'm doing this for the money. I'm not doing this for my family. I'm doing this to essentially pay for my college fund, but this is scary. So talk about that moment.
Well, I mean, in racing, there's a lot of scary moments. Obviously, you're going very fast. There's a bunch of other cars around you. And I would say when I was 8 years old, which this wasn't scary to me because I was basically a daredevil back then, but I'm in this little bitty car they call a Bandolero, and we're going about 80 miles an hour around this track. And unfortunately, we raced during the time of day where the sun was straight into my eyes going into the first turn. So I couldn't see the car that had spun out in front of me, and I hit them head-on, did a barrel roll, and landed on my wheels. I would say that's the scariest moment that I remember, but I remember that day looking at my car and trying to see if there's a way to fix it to get back on track. But now that I look back at that, that was a pretty scary wreck.
So you flipped the vehicle when you were 8 years old. Is that what you're telling me? Jeez, Austin, I'd be surprised if you didn't get head injuries from that. And now, okay, I know with Formula One, I know it's a paved track. And with stock car, is it dust or are you on a paved track? And I know with Indy 500, of course, you're on a paved track. So explain to the idiots out there in common language of what I just said, because I know little to nothing about race car driving.
Well, basically, there's 4 to 5 different types of racing when it comes to cars. I race paved ovals, or some people just say I race in circles. But, I race paved ovals, which is basically just asphalt, and then the cars go race on there with sticky tires. But then there's also dirt oval racing, which I really want to get into, where the track is made of nothing but dirt. I got to test one car in that one time. And then there's rallycross racing, which a lot of people know about, where it's basically dirt, asphalt, and jumps. And then there's dirt road course racing, which has the big, big trophy trucks that are jumping and sliding. And then there's paved road racing, which is a road course, but that, I want to say, has the most amount of classes in them. So there's lots of different types of racing, but I'm pretty much in the paved oval circuit right now.
Okay, so you're in the lower version of Daytona.
Yeah, Daytona is like the goal. Obviously, being a 13, I can't go on there yet because 200 miles an hour
is too
fast for a 13-year-old.
So in a couple of years,
that's what I should be doing, though.
In a couple years, you're going to be doing Daytona. I just have a funny feeling. And, yeah, I should have put parental guidance on this. Do not be running to your mamas and dads saying, I want to do this, because I heard a cool race car driver on Wins podcast, because race car driving is scary. It's biking for me is scary, and I'm on a low speed bike. I can't imagine in a race car what you must feel. I mean, you must have gotten the adrenaline pumping the first day, and it hasn't stopped you yet. But when you owned the vehicle when you were 8 years old, I'm like, maybe that stops you, or maybe that put a little bit of a perspective on how dangerous this is.
Well, I mean, we're in these cars going stupid fast, but they're built very, very strong. The frame is very, very strong metal to where any sort of impact will keep us safe. We have a full fireproof suit, gloves, shoes, helmet. The helmet obviously protects my head from any head impacts. And I also have a Hans device, which prevents my head from flying forward if I happen to get on a head-on collision. So, I mean, it is dangerous, but honestly, I'm safer in that car than I am driving down the street in a normal car.
Really? Yes. Well, that's good to know, because I'm looking at these Daytona 500 drivers thinking, are they really safe? See, I learned something from you, Austin. Now I know that watching Daytona 500 on TV, these cars are really safe. And so, okay, because you're 13 and at the professional level for a 13-year-old, what is your life achievement? When you retire from all this, is it to go to college, or is it to give it back, or what? What do you want to do with money? I'm presuming you're getting paid to do this by sponsors.
Not yet. That's the goal.
Not yet. That's the goal. The goal is to get
a living off of
you sponsored. Yeah. But how could you, how, that being said, if not yet, if you're not sponsored yet, how expensive is the sport?
Well, I mean, it gets worse and worse as we go. Like, I know the cars that race at Daytona
are priced
anywhere from $50,000 to $200,000 at least.
Yeah.
But right now, I'm in a $20,000 stock car. Me and my dad do all the work to it. If it gets in a crash or if it needs something gone through, me and my dad do all the work to it. So we're not being able to pay for a crew. We usually aren't able to put new tires on it every race like other drivers do. I mean, it is expensive, but luckily we've had a lot of family and friends that have been in it for a long time that wanted to help out. And this is actually the youngest that kids have ever been able to do this. Usually you have to be 14 to ever be in a stock car like this, but I've been doing it since I was 11.
I was just going to say, what's the age limit on doing stock cars? I mean, jeez. As I said, watching the Daytona 500 scares me as a, and trust me, I have been scared once in my life doing Kona Ironman, and I was on the other side of it, and yeah. And so I'm the adrenaline junkie, but when it comes down to it, I presume that the your parents are very willing to help you, and if you said, I want to stop, they wouldn't force you to get back on the track.
Well, of
course, but
I,
what
we're doing this because I wanted to
course,
do it.
Yeah, you're doing this because you want to do it and eventually get paid to do it. And so, okay, what would you recommend for those adrenaline junkies out there like myself who want to get into something competitive? Is it practice makes perfect? I mean, what coming from your eyes is it?
It all depends. Like, if obviously a lot of people can't come up with the funds like we can, even then we don't have that much funds. But if you want to just go have fun and get your adrenaline pumping, there's just local go-kart tracks all around where you can race against people and go for a good time. But if you really want to get into it, you've got to find your local short track or your local road course and then kind of find another racer and get details from them because everybody's different. Like, in the class that I'm racing right now, my home track, the Orangeville Speedway, races about 10 different classes. I'm in the top class, the super late model series. But it, depending on your age and your funding, there are all sorts of different classes that you could do. But if you want to do it professionally, like I'm trying to do, it takes a lot of practice, funding, help, and really drive to do it because it's already been very hard to get up to where we're at right now. We're not even at the top yet.
Yeah. And so what has been your favorite race so far that you have done?
I would say 2 years ago. The Junior Late Model Series is what I'm racing in right now. The Super Late Model Series, I'm only cleared to race at Orangeville Speedway because I showed really good talent there. But at the other tracks that I race at, it's the Junior Late Model Series, which is 10 to 16-year-olds. And that's when we had just found out about the series a little while ago. And I was 11 at the time. And we went to Madero Speedway right outside of Fresno in Central California. And it was our second race, and we were learning. We didn't know much about the cars yet or anything, and I was still really small learning how to drive them. And we ended up winning that race, and, I mean, that was really special. But there are a million other races I could say. Like, even at my home track, the Orangeville Speedway, in the mini stock division, which is actually Ford Pintos that they turned into race cars, I became the youngest to set a fast time that day and win the race, and it's kind of cool to set history at a track like that. So there's a million different races I could name, but I think those are probably my two favorite.
Well, setting time and going into a history book, my goodness. And so you don't need a driver's license to do this, although you might need some sort of a license to do this. Do you?
Some tracks do and some tracks don't. Like, I know the Irwindale Speedway, which is about an hour away from my house here. I think that they require a NASCAR license because they're a NASCAR-based track. But then there are tracks like the Orangeville Speedway and the Madeira Speedway. They're just local and they don't require a license. It all depends. You don't really need a license unless there are the certain tracks that require a racing license, which you just pay for at the beginning of the year, basically says that you're able to drive the car. But, it doesn't change anything for me driver license-wise. I still have to wait till I'm 16 to get a driver's license and all that if I don't end up going that road.
Of course you do. Of course you do. No advantages, except you get driver's ed in these cars. You get driver's ed and the rest of your classmates want to be like you so they don't have to just drive ahead. But how do your classmates feel about this? your track mate's okay with having a semi-professional race car driver in their class, or do they just think that's the boringest sport on the planet?
Well, I mean, a lot of them have never been to a race, so I'm not sure they could really say much about it, but everybody at my school knows about it. They don't pay much attention to it. I mean, a couple years ago in fifth grade, I did a leadership presentation when I was driving a Southwest tour truck, which, by the way, my Southwest tour truck, I was the youngest to ever drive it. I was 9 years old in a full-size 300-horsepower truck that I started racing and actually did okay in. But, yeah, I mean, my classmates, they know about it. They don't pay much attention to it. But obviously, if anything that has to do with racing or a race car driver comes to our school, they look right at me and go, hey, look at that. So, I mean, they know about it. It's not anything special to them, but the ones that have gone to races, I think they kind of realize how much of a big deal it is.
They get it. They get it. See, they may not get the concept of it in the classroom, but once you're out there, you get it.
Well, yeah, in the classroom, I'm just another kid. I go to school normally.
Yeah.
The only difference is after school, I come home, do my homework, and I go straight to working on my car. But when I'm at school, I'm just another kid, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, just another kid, and you do this on the weekends. And so you are in a public school system, I'm presuming, and then you haven't gotten to the point where you need to homeschool.
Yeah, we're not at that point yet. Obviously, right now, I've been racing throughout the West Coast, but coming either late this year or sometime next year will probably be the point to where if we can get enough people to help us out, that I'll start traveling back east to race there and come back here, and I'll be flying back and forth, so I'll miss a lot of school. So it's possible that I might have to go homeschooling soon, but for right now, I'm able to stay in school. I'm going into eighth grade this year.
Well, good. Well, I am happy that you're able to stay in the public school system, but homeschooling is an option, and for you, it may be easier because this is something you really want to do. And the reason why I want you on and the reason why I published this suggestion to you is because here you are, soon to be eighth grader, and you're living your dreams like there's no tomorrow. You said, I really want to do this. Let's put the funding in. Let's put the time in and see how I do.
Yeah, it all kind of started, my dad let me test out a go-kart for the first time at 4 years old in a high school parking lot, and that started it all. But, I mean, there's some people that some say are born with it. Like, I was able to parallel park my power wheels. Like, I would have a handbrake, and I would lock up the rear tires and slide into a parking spot between two other power wheels when I was 2 years old. So, I mean, they could kind of see that I had it from the beginning, but they put me in a go-kart, and I won my second race ever, and it's just been something that my family's done for a long time. It goes all the way back to when my grandfather did it in the 1960s, and then my grandfather did it, then my uncle, then my dad did, then my cousins did, and here I am in full-size stock car at 13, so.
Yeah, so this is in your blood, so no taking you often away from the tracks. If someone said you had to go away from the tracks, you would probably kick them and scream and say no, because it's in your blood.
Yep, it's going to stay with me. That's why I'm trying to make a career out of it, because I don't know what it is, but just the adrenaline itself.
It is going to stay with you. And now, Austin, I'm going to have you interview me and see what you can pull out of me. And trust me, you guys, these questions are not planned. by me or they're led by my guest, and we do it naturally, so I'm going to let this 13-year-old interview me, this adrenaline junkie interview me. I should probably be a little bit more prepared to be interviewed by adrenaline junkies, but that's okay.
So I should just start asking you questions?
Yeah, just go on.
What is the, how about the thing that is basically got your adrenaline going the most? Like, what's the most heart-pumping thing that you've ever done to get your adrenaline pumping?
Okay. It has to be, rock climbing or snowboarding. It has to be rock climbing or snowboarding, and biking doesn't do it. Biking is just a form of exercise, just to get exercise. And so it has to be snowboarding or rock climbing, either one. And
I know the
that
snowboarding
really,
because I used to be a skier, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so that either one gives me a wall to climb up. And, yes, I do rock climbing once a week. And, yes, I am starting to go outdoor rock climbing, believe it or not. That was just presented to me last week. And I said, okay, let's do it. Let's try it. I'm the one that... I know the type that wants to try it. It was my dad's idea to go rock climbing originally, and I have to give him full credit. It wasn't my idea. So even though I have GP, I still like the physical therapy aspect of it. And so snowboarding and rock climbing are two of my adrenaline junkie things.
So the rock climbing deal, I don't know very much about rock climbing at all, but I would say what's probably the highest you've gotten in rock climbing? Like, I don't know, altitude or just height period?
I get pretty high. And now granted, it's a rock climbing wall at a local gym. So surprisingly, I get pretty high. And for me, that due to my spinal fusion than my legs, for me, that is a blessing in disguise, because one of the things you have to do in rock climbing, even when you are on a wall, you have to pay attention. You have to pay attention. I feel like, now I have a guide guiding me, so, but you still have to pay attention. You have to decide where you're going to put your feet. You have to decide where you're going to put your hands. You have to decide. I feel like if you make one false move, you go flying backwards.
Yeah. I've actually done that before, at a summer camp I went to one time. That was spring, I want to say. It was a spring camp, whatever you want to call it. But I was on a rock wall, and I made it to the top and fell off. Luckily, they had a harness on me, and they caught me a couple feet before the ground.
Oh, God. Okay. Yeah. So I typically don't go flying back with you guys. I'm pretty graceful, but... when you do a rock climbing wall at camp, which I have done too, I started rock climbing when I was 10 years old without a spinal fusion. So I started doing it when I was 10 years old. Now I took many, many years off, and I should have, because I'm like, I know how to do this.
That's pretty amazing, actually.
So, yeah.
I'm not used to interviewing people, so I'm trying to think of a question here. Should probably go something car-related. What's the fastest you've ever gone in a car?
The fastest I've ever gone in a normal vehicle, geez, I would say 100, because quite 100. Frankly, and I'm sorry to say, my dad's a speed. My dad's a speed demon. He's a speed demon, and he'll admit it. He, And I was going to say earlier, we're driving a street legal vehicle. And so it's like, oh my God, you drive 100 miles an hour. He doesn't do it that often, thank God. But car related, and I love my cars. I wish I could. I tried, you guys don't know this, but I tried getting my driver's license when I was 16, and they wouldn't give it to me because of my Sam Pauli. And the reason why they wouldn't give it to me is because they said, you don't have to put so much that your starter reaction is way too high. And my starter reaction has gotten better, but it hasn't. So they wouldn't give me a driver's license, and I was so mad. I'm like, give me that driver's license. So if I need to try again, I need to try again. But they deem me in the state of Colorado not legal to drive.
Again, I'm not used to interviewing people, so I gotta think for a minute. How about your favorite type of car? Like, it can be street legal, non-street legal, because of how fast it is, because of how
nice.
Oh, anything.
Nice. The, as I said, the Daytona 500 vehicles are the coolest looking vehicles I have ever seen in my life, and I don't know how they do it. Of course, these guys are sponsored, let's just say that. So they have the funding to get all those cool stickers on the side. But my favorite, I like a good vehicle that has speed to it. I do not like a slow vehicle. A Ferrari would be one of my favorite vehicles, or a stock car vehicle like you drive. I mean, as long as it has speed to it, I'm happy.
You know, actually, one fun fact about the Daytona 500 cars, the Cup cars, all those stickers on the side actually aren't stickers. The actual entire car is actually one big sticker. It's called a wrap. The car is literally made of one huge sticker that is just laid over it and lined up so perfectly that it looks like that on the track.
I did not know that. See, you taught me something I did not know. See, Austin was teaching all of us interested Jackson. I thought there was an age limit. There's a little bit of an age limit, but as long as you do it safely, you can basically get away with it. And I did not know about the interesting fact about the Daytona 500 that they actually lay one sticker on and make it perfect.
How about, now I'm just going to start thinking of random stuff because I'm out of things, so.
Oh, that's okay. Think of random stuff. That's okay.
How about, let's say, what is one just random fact, period, that people just wouldn't know about you? Just one random fact that nobody knows about you.
God, now you stumped me. When random facts that people don't know about me, well, I know I'm an author, but you didn't know this. I published my first book when I was 13. I published my first book when I was 16, and that's how I fell in love with the self-publishing industry. I didn't get back to it until I was 23, but I published my first book when I was 16.
Really? Well, what was the name of it?
It was a coffee table. Actually, it would have been when I was 18, almost 19, and it was a coffee table book on art, my art work, because I used to be a self-taught digital artist, so I fell in love with the self-publishing industry at age 18.
Wow. How many books have you written since then?
I have written 8 books, nine, including that one, but that one was a coffee table book. So I have written 8 books, and I actually do make money off my books. My books can be found on Amazon, they could be found on Apple iBooks on all Apple devices, on Nooks, on Kindles, on Kobos up in Canada. So, yeah. So I actually make money off my book. Now, my first experiment in the self-publishing industry, being 18, I did not know that I was just testing it out in a coffee table book. I did not know that I was going to do this as a side hustle.
Well, I think I have one last question. Being that I work with an animal shelter in my area, and I've been raising money for them for quite a while now, are you a cat person or a dog person?
If I had my brothers and if I could get away with them, which right now I don't have any animals, which makes me so sad, I am a dog person, and my next big feat, you guys, is pretty much in the next couple of years, if I can find one and need one, is to get a service dog, because I want to see what they can do. I have had pets growing up, but they weren't trained as a service dog, and of course getting a service animal there's a stigma with it, and it's expensive. It's expensive getting a service dog because they need specialized training. So that will be in the next 5 years that I'm going to get a service dog. So I am a dog person. I'm a dog person all the way. And even though I don't have any pets right now, I want a service dog to help me with my family process.
Well, I brought that up because I work with a non-kill shelter in my area, Yaps. It's a non-profit shelter that they run basically just based on donations. They keep the dogs there until they go home, and it's an amazing thing because I don't even know of one dog that came in and no one could go near her, and now she's been there for 3 years and is friendly to everybody. So I don't want to turn the page to me, but what I've been trying to do, what my goal is through racing is, like I said, I want to make a difference along the way. And one of the biggest thing I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make more shelters non-kill shelters and basically stop euthanasia or kill shelters from obviously killing the dogs. So that's what I've been trying to do is I've been helping out yaps since I was 9 now, and hopefully pretty soon I'm trying to turn this into a nonprofit. In fact, my website, quickpaws.support, you can look more about it on there, but basically what I'm trying to do is once I get my racing going and actually am able to make money off of it, what I'm trying to do is make more shelters around the country non-kill shelters. So hopefully in 5 years when I'm racing Daytona and I've had enough money to do some of that, hopefully you'll be adopting a service dog from a non-kill shelter.
I believe in no-kill shelters myself. I mean, the fact that dogs go into animal shelters every single day, and it's like, now what? Now what? We have a human population / a dog population, and what I would like to do is, now this is public, what I would like to do is adopt a mutt, is adopt a service dog out of the service, out of the animal shelter. And you guys don't know this, you thought I was going to adopt a purebred dog. Oh no, I'm going to go the, if I ever get to the point where I'm going to get a service dog, I'm going to adopt a puppy out of a animal shelter and train it. Train it because he or she might have less problems than the typical service dog who is the golden retriever. They use labs, they use golden retrievers too, but because of all the breeding, then you run into all these, I don't want to say all these nasty problems. I mean, I grew up with a dog who had to get his tail cut off because he had lumps on his tail, and luckily my mom was willing to do it. But I made the decision that day that my Cuban Kerry Blue's tail got cut off, that I'm like, if I ever get a service dog, it's going to be a mutt, it's going to be rescued, and it's going to have the proper training. And even though they use Labrador retrievers, golden retrievers, yeah, I'm going to beat to the different drum with the service dog. I'm sorry, but that's the way I feel.
You know, after talking about all this, I was able to think of one more question. What's your favorite type of dog? Is it one of the dogs that you had named, one of the service dogs, like the Golden Retriever or Lab, or is it something completely different?
It's going, if I was going to do a purebred, quote, service dog, where it would have to be a Labradoodle, because one of the problems with me is I have weak lungs, so I don't want a dog that sheds. I don't want a dog. See, I'm picky when it comes to my service dog. You can't hand me any service dog, so I know they use Labradoodles for service dog too. So if you give me a Labradoodle, especially if he's a mutt coming out of the animal shelter, I would be the happiest camper on the planet, because that way I'm saving a dog / training him to my needs / he won't shed, because half these dogs, I mean, the golden retrievers, they're wonderful, but you'll find hair on you, on everything, and you, I don't personally want to be cleaning up hair because of a dog shedding. I mean, a dog is a huge responsibility, as you will know often, and as everyone well knows, but give me a labradoodle and give me a, I'll give me a mutt that doesn't shed, and I'll be the happiest person on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, I have two dachshunds and a basset hound, actually, in my house, and they're all flat hairs. I mean, they're not supposed to shed, but you sit one on my lap for 5 minutes, and they get up, and I've got a mountain of hair on my lap. Like,
yes.
I don't get it. You're not supposed to shed. Why?
I don't get it either. No, my a friend of mine has a blue healer, and well, she did have a blue healer. I don't know what she has now, but I'm like, I love you, but your dog is getting hair all over me. And granted, this is my best friend, and granted, she doesn't care. And it's like, I love you, but you're getting hair all over me. I also, my mother, who I lost, was an asthmatic, too. So I grew up with non-shedding dogs, and so that makes me even pickier, because that's what I'm used to. I'm not used to golden retrievers that shed, and so, yeah. So me and shedding dogs do not mix. The other, the rest of the dogs, I will take care of. I just don't want to deal with the shedding. And I just don't want to deal with the hair.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've gotten used to it, too. I always go down to the shelter, and I actually volunteer, socialize the dogs. But I think the coolest thing that I've actually been able to do is, obviously, dogs coming into a shelter, sometimes they're scared. Sometimes their owner surrenders. The owner couldn't keep it anymore, so they give them to the shelter. So, obviously, they go in, and they're scared. And some of them can be aggressive. Some of them can just run away from you. So, I think the coolest thing that I've been able to do is, I mean, I did this to my first dog when I was 9. I went to the shelter constantly throughout the week, and I actually was able to rehabilitate the dog, you know, get him used to people again, get him more socializable again, get him some more yard time, get some more exercise. I've been able to do stuff like that with about 6 different dogs, and I think that's pretty much the cool thing that I've been able to do, is actually get dogs used to people again so that they can go home.
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, shelters are a good thing, but when they kill animals, it breaks my heart. So if I was, as I said, if I was going to get a service dog, one, it would have to be a mutt. Two, it would have to be a labradoodle because they don't shed. One, and then I would train it to meet my specific needs, and yeah, I mean, that's what I want to do. I want to pull a dog out of the animal shelter that is looking for a new lease on life, because trust me, I've had dogs like this. I believe there is an overpopulation of Cuban dogs, and it's not a pretty picture when you bring the other Cuban dog home and he has all these medical issues out the yin yang, then you have to spend more money at the vet. So sometimes I think personally having a mutt would be easier than a Cuban dog, and I know I'm getting a lot of people yelling at me because I grew up with my aunt. My aunt had a beautiful mutt, Heinz 57. Actually, they call it in Bahamas a pot cake. And he was put Rottweiler. He looked like a Rottweiler but had the sweetest disposition. I don't know what he was. He was more Rottweiler, but on the sweeter side. And I loved that dog. Half to death. The dog is no longer with us. But I'm like, now there's a dog that just needed a second chance in life. And of course, he had mental issues too. But he was just the mother was the mother dog was walking on the side of an airport road, and one of my aunt's workers picked this dog up and brought him to her and said, do you want this dog? And of course, my aunt being tosty that she is, said yes. And they also rescued a cat out of a tree. And so I've been used to dogs all my life, and I've been used to the two-bed dogs / the mutts. I prefer the mutts rather than the two-beds, but that's just me. And speaking of no-kill shelters, I believe that we have a no-kill shelter here, but no-kill shelters are hard to find.
Yeah, that's basically why I'm trying to do what I'm doing, to get more no-kill shelters out there to obviously save more dogs and stop shelters from having
save more dogs than cats, too.
Cats,
save
yeah,
more
I,
dogs than
I didn't
cats.
I mention them. I'm
because,
a dog person, so I hardly ever think of cats. But, yeah, I'm trying to help
no,
them, too.
No, but
so.
my sister actually adopted a kitty from a shelter down in Denver, and she loves that cat half to death. And so, so we're trying to save animals on the, this is the Save Animals Ask Wim podcast today with Austin, because, that's what Austin and I are passionate about. You guys didn't know I was so passionate about saving animals. I'll save a fish if you let me. And so, yeah, but I feel the exact same way you do. Maybe it's the Generation Z or the millennials in us that want to not watch a dog being killed. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I know you're Generation Z, but I'm a millennial, and I'm on the other side of millennial. But I'm like, I would rather have a muck than a human dog any day. And it's like, really? So, yes. And so, yeah. And what I was going to say before I let Austin go is anyone can walk into a shelter and say, can I walk a dog? Anyone, if you want your heart filled with joy, just go to the animal shelter for 1 hour and take a dog out. And because they need human interaction. I mean, these dogs walk in, scared half to death, get surrendered by the owner, and now they're thinking, my owner doesn't love me, so I might as well not love people.
Yeah, in fact, if I could touch on one other thing. A lot of the problems that I see when people go to adopt from shelters, and for anyone that's listening to this podcast and is looking to adopt a dog, it's just as helpful to adopt from a shelter as it is a non-kill shelter. But what I wanted to say is you're probably going to go in there and you're probably not going to find a dog that isn't scared. Obviously, we already said reasons why they probably are scared in the first place, but in the 4 or 5 years that I've been working with dogs, I realized that they are going to be scared because they're at a shelter, and with all the other dogs there and all the things going on and being locked in the cage, they are going to act scared. It's very rare to find a dog that will be happy in that scenario. So obviously, like you had just said a minute ago, taking a dog out and walking them and getting used to their personality, if you take a dog out of that shelter and you just walk them or you foster them and take them to their home, they turn into a completely different dog. I saw it with this dog at Yaps. Malky came in, she was found on the street. She had puppies there. She was already pregnant before, and she just had a hard time. But in between the 3 years that she's been there, she had gone to a foster home, and as soon as she came back, she was a completely different dog. So anyone listening that either now wants to adopt a dog or was looking to adopt a dog, I just want y'all to know that the dog's personality at the shelter won't be the same as when it goes home. When it goes home, I can almost guarantee it will be better.
And ask questions, because I was about 10 that we adopted a dog from a shelter. He was a black lab, and my dad and I went out of town. My mom went to the shelter, said, can I take a dog for 24 hours? And, yeah. And, of course, when I got home from what I was doing with my dad, the sweet 10-year-old, I asked my mom, can we please teach the dog? Of course, she said, yes, of course. Unbeknownst to all of us, he was aggressive towards men.
Oh.
I almost killed him. Mom, I'm like, you didn't ask that question. You're living with a 6-foot-tall guy who's your husband. And so my dad got so mad at my mom, because now we had this big black lab at this house, and we had to give him up, and that was just heartbreaking. So my point being of telling that story about Maverick was that ask questions of the shelter. Like, is this dog aggressive to men? Is this dog good around other dogs? Is this dog good around cats? Is this dog good around kids? And if you have another dog and you're trying, you adopt the dog, make sure they meet on neutral ground, you guys, because I don't want to hear it from you guys, oh, I adopted a dog, you brought him home, and now he doesn't get along with my cat, or now he doesn't get along with my other dog. He's perfectly fine, because coming out of that sheltered environment, you'll never know what you're going to ask. You never know what you're going to get. So ask the shelter, make a list of questions, and they can be strange questions too, but make the list of questions and ask the shelter if you're going to adopt the dog or cat. Is the cat good around kids? Is the cat good around dogs? Is the cat good at going to the bathroom? I mean, they might not tell you if the cat doesn't use a little box, or the dog doesn't go outside, they may not tell you, because they want these dogs taken out of there to make more space. But you guys have got to ask questions.
Yeah, well, sometimes the shelters have to guess, because obviously not everybody at the shelter that works there is able to work with every single dog. So one thing that's also helpful, if when you're fostering a dog, obviously there's fostering it to adopt it, just seeing how it does it your house, obviously. But if another way you could help a shelter without actually adopting a dog or donating to it is to foster the dog, period. And what this allows you to do is it gets the dog used to a home scenario. You get to know its characteristics, and then you can basically write it down on a list, and you'll know better details about that dog than the shelter people will, to where when people come to adopt it, then you actually have the specific details, and that dog is way less likely to come back. So that's another way to help shelter.
Way less likely to come back.
Yeah,
good
exactly.
Point. Good point. Let's pull these dogs out and foster them in a home and buy them. And I'm glad I know you're in California, but you can do this across the country, I know. And the dogs, the humans, the cats would be forever grateful to you guys if you went to the animal shelter and just took them out for an hour and socialized them, because they don't do very well in cages. Humans do not do very well in cages. Dogs do not do very well in cages. We all need love, and that's what Austin is trying to do with his racing career. He not only has a passion about racing, but he has a passion about saving dogs and cats here. So I want to have you guys help Austin as much as you can. And when we see him at this month's level at the Daytona 500, I'm going to be pretty positive that he's going to have a sticker on his car to win a dog chow. I'm pretty dang positive, because that's what he's really passionate about. And that means that you guys can donate toys to the animal shelter, donate a cat tray, donate a bag of dog food if you have one lying around. Because animal shelters, even though they're wonderful, they don't have the money to supply all these dogs, especially these no-kill shelters. So I just wanted to throw that in there, that PSA, go cuddle a cat, go walk a dog, and make Austin and I happy. Now, where can people find you, Austin, and how can people get a hold of you if they want to know more about you? And then if they want to help with the cause, how can they do that?
Well, you could find me on my website at quickpaws.support, or you could find me on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at First Place Ace, just to see some cute pictures of dogs and see my racing career grow.
Oh, boy. Cute pictures of dogs. Oh, boy. The reason why I'm saying oh, boy, is because Instagram goes cute pictures of dogs. And so I think all my fans will be going over to Instagram, and of course I'll be going over to Instagram and following you and seeing cute pictures of dogs. Thanks, Austin, for that little cute pictures of dogs and crazy cat videos. That doesn't help my fan base. That doesn't help my fan base, because we get sucked into cute dogs and cute cats. But anyway, that's the cause. That's the downfalls of helping cats and dogs. They end up being cute, and you want to take everyone home, and of course your parents will probably say no. And unlike my mom said to a 10-year-old, of course we can keep a dog. I'm like, Mom, you are too much of a softy, and she was. And so I don't be a softy like my mom to your kids. Please, please, when they say, can we adopt a dog? And, yeah, that's a long story. That's a whole nother podcast in itself. But I would love to thank Austin, and let's just help his cause out, and let's just watch his career grow, and hopefully he'll come back on my podcast when he's at the professional level, and then we can talk about being a professional at this. Because if you have a dream, you can live it just like Austin is. And if you have a cause on the side, you can also do it just like Austin is. And I appreciate you guys listening to this podcast. My books couldn't be found on Amazon. They can also be found on Apple iBooks. and Nooks and Kobolds. And so if you go look up Icon the Win in iBooks, you can find that. And then if you go to Amazon and type in my name, that's going to be perfectly fine. And then if you guys want to contact me, and I'll pin this podcast to the top of my Twitter profile as soon as I get it up, that will probably be on Friday that it comes out. And so as soon as I get it up, I'll pin this profile so Austin can retweet it and share it with his fan base. And so we'll get traction to the dogs, and we'll also get traction to Formula Racing, because I think Austin is a wonderful spokesperson for the Uncommon Racing community. And I just hope you guys enjoyed another fabulous episode. Thank you, guys, and thank you, Austin, and good luck with your career.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Bye.